It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today joining us, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, joining us after a little bit of an absence. Jim, welcome back to our studio in Ames.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be back.
In our Des Moines studio, Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Drake University in Des Moines. He's also Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute of Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Always wonderful to have you in our studio as well, Dennis.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Jim.
Happy New Year to you both and to all of our listeners. This is our first Politics Wednesday edition in 2017. And a lot of politics, of course, 2016 will be remembered for, but as we're starting now, 2017 doesn't seem to be any less promising. Let's, as far as political junkies are concerned, later in the hour, we want to talk about this curious event on Monday, House Republicans going behind closed doors to curtail severely their own ethics watchdog and then reversing course after a backlash. Also, the fact that President-elect Trump is still very skeptical about Russian hacking to influence the election. And North Korea, nuclear-capable North Korea, says it's close to test-launching an intercontinental ballistic missile. Talk about the threat there and what can be done. But first of all, what we heard in the top of the hour's news, the challenge facing Republicans in repealing and placing Obamacare. Of course, during the very long campaign, we heard it again and again, Donald Trump, also congressional Republicans vowing to move quickly to repeal President Obama's signature health care law. At a news conference this morning, House Speaker Paul Ryan talked about how the GOP will handle the transition of replacing the Affordable Care Act. Well, he really didn't offer too much detail. Let's have a listen.
President-elect is making an important point that we're trying to emphasize right here today, and that is so much damage has already been done to the country. Obamacare is a story of broken promise after broken promise after broken promise, followed by failing program, higher premiums, higher deductibles. So we want to make sure that as we give relief to people through Obamacare, we do it in a transition that doesn't pull the rug out from anybody during that transition period. That's the point that we're all trying to make. This law has failed. It's getting worse. Families are hurting. No one has choices. We've got to fix this by replacing it with something better. And in that transition, we want to make sure we don't pull the rug out from anybody during that transition. That's the point we're all trying to make.
So why still no plan to replace it?
We have a plan to replace it. We have plenty of ideas to replace it. And you'll see as the weeks and months unfold what we're talking about replacing it, how we can get better choices with lower prices by not having a cost of government takeover of health care, which is causing all this problem in the first place.
Of course, we heard in our news as well, Vice President-elect Mike Pence talking with Republican lawmakers on Capitol Hill today, and also juxtaposing that with the closed-door meeting with Democratic lawmakers today, President Obama urging fellow Democrats, we heard in our news, not to rescue Republicans by helping them pass replacement measures. He also brought up the idea to have them refer to the GOP's new plan as Trump care. So, Dennis, let me turn to you. Talk about the challenge for Republicans carrying through, following through with their pledge to repeal and replace.
The dog has chased the car for about 6, 7, 8 years now and has finally caught the car and has got to decide what to do with it. Republicans have been on that chase for all this time. They voted something like 60 times in the House to scale back or repeal the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, even if it passed the Senate, the president vetoed those. So now they actually have the power to do this, although the procedure is incredibly arcane. But nonetheless, they have the power to do this, and they're facing their moment of truth. Okay, are we really going to do this? What kind of blowback will there be from the people, and there are quite a few, who have benefited from the Affordable Care Act, even if not everybody has benefited in the way that might have been expected?
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation as we talk about various issues, including the Affordable Care Act, its seemingly imminent repeal. We'll see how imminent that is. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you're directly affected by the Affordable Care Act. Perhaps you're one of these people who were previously not covered by insurance who is now. Perhaps you're one of the people who was forced to pay even though you didn't want to pay for health insurance. 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. We're also on Facebook. You could leave a comment or a question there. So let me get your input, Jim McCormick, on this, too. So we have popular provisions of Obamacare, and I believe the Republicans, haven't they already pledged to not to get rid of the pre-existing health conditions, preventing patients with pre-existing health conditions from being denied coverage, allowing young people to stay up to the age of 26 on their parents' health plan. So does this square with where the Republicans are going?
No, I don't think it does, actually, at the outset. But it was interesting what Ryan had to say, because what I took from his statement was that they really want to go slow on this because they don't want to hurt anybody, and they're going to try to retain some of those provisions that you just outlined. It's not going to be a total repeal. I think the other thing you could read into what Ryan said in your statement there, of what you played, is that the GOP doesn't really agree on how they want to replace Obamacare. So I think we're going to see this kind of slow walk with regard to replacing Obamacare, because they don't want the backlash that they got, and we will talk about it later, over this ethics kind of maneuver that they tried within the past couple of days here.
Mm-hmm. Don't forget, though, the group in the House that calls themselves the Freedom Caucus, Tea Party members. They're the hardliners in this regard.
Steve King is one of those.
Right. I believe there are about 40 of them. And they have the votes, if they want, to disrupt the Republican leadership. They helped chase out John Boehner, of course, a couple of years ago. But they are absolutely dedicated to repeal immediately. Now, somebody compared this to saying, well, you're going to jump out of the plane and you're going to knit your parachute on the way down. But right. Nonetheless, that's what these guys want to do, even if there isn't anything to replace it now. Simply allowing people to buy health insurance across state lines has always been a Republican point. But that's not going to solve the basic problem.
Tom is joined. Yeah, go ahead, Jim, before we go to our phones.
But I think Ryan is much more nimble than John Boehner in terms of holding his caucus together here. So I'm not sure. I mean, Dennis may well be right that the House Freedom Caucus could sort of rip out Obamacare entirely. But I think Ryan has got his ear to the ground much more than Boehner did.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Dennis Goldford of Drake University. It's Politics Wednesday, talking at the moment about the Affordable Care Act. A lot of things happening right now. One of the priorities of the new incoming president, elected Trump, and also the Republican Congress. Tom is with us in Sioux City. Hi, Tom. You have a question about the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, I have a question. Not a question, but just kind of a comment, in that this really points out the hubris and the plain stupidity of your typical Republican congressman to me, because they're in denial about everything that all serious academics, a lot of them with Nobel economics prizes, are saying what can happen with this thing if they do repeal it, but they just either don't care or they're so stupid they don't know. I mean, I can barely trust Steve King to run a small construction company in Kyron, let alone mess with a $300 billion health insurance program just on the subsidy.
Okay, let's get a reaction, Tom, to your point there. Can you, Jim, keep these popular provisions of the Affordable Care Act without making health insurance coverage mandatory?
I'm not sure that you can, really. I mean, in terms of if you want to make certain that pre-existing conditions are not challenged by insurance companies, if you can still allow insurance. I don't know how you do that without an enforcement mechanism. The same holds true for allowing somebody to stay on their parents' insurance until they're mm-hmm. 26.
Dennis, you talk about knitting the parachute as you fall out of the plane, but this is the other prong here of the problem for the Republicans here. How do you deliver, keep the popular parts and then take away one of the biggest complaints against Obamacare is people are forced to be insured, to pay.
That's the problem. I mean, nobody can figure out how to fund this thing except through the individual mandate, however well or poorly that's operated so far. I mean, it is incredibly complex legislation. The people that back a single-payer program say that would be a lot simpler. Just have a certain amount of taxation that goes toward that, the way you find in Germany or Great Britain or places like that. But we don't do it that way. They wrapped in the insurance companies, and you know, it's the old problem that you can't let people just buy health insurance when they're in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. So the enforcement element, however unpopular it's been, has been the individual mandate, and that's one of the things that Republicans have just opposed with all their might and all their being. And if you take that out and do nothing else, the deficit goes up, from my understanding. And they haven't really addressed the problem yet that we've seen as to how they're going to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. And there's not going to be any Democratic cooperation. I noticed on your newscast here that the president went up to Capitol Hill and told the Democrats to be united. And as you may recall, Obamacare was passed without a single Republican vote. It looks like any kind of action now on Obamacare will be done without any kind of Democratic involvement.
But Jim, couldn't there be also divisions within the Democratic ranks there that some would say, hey, hold the hard line that the president, Obama, seems to want? Others say, well, let's do compromise. Let's not dig in our feet like the Republicans did to us.
Well, it would be those 25 senators that are up for re-election in 2018. On the Democratic side, those would be clearly the most vulnerable.
Right, at least 10 of whom are in states that Trump won.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to ask you both, how much is this about a perception? How and why the Affordable Care Act ends or is changed? I guess, could we, Dennis, see a makeover with the fundamental elements of Obamacare and then repackaged as Trump Care? Is it really just a matter of one party wanting to claim it, because it's obvious that we need to do something about health care in this country?
Well,
or are they fundamentally different approaches, I guess?
Well, you know, the Republicans claim constantly, and it's a matter of political rhetoric, that this was a government takeover of health insurance and health care. Well, that's not what it was. That's why it's so complicated. Again, as I said, because they built in the private insurance companies. It wasn't a government takeover, but still there's a bigger government role, certainly in terms of regulations and funding. The Republicans always claim that the best, the most efficient, the lowest cost solution to all this is a free market in health care. And that presumes that health care is something that operates like a free market. Again, I mentioned the ambulance example. I mean, if I'm semi-conscious in an ambulance on the way to the hospital, it's not going to do them much good to ask me which hospital I want to go to, and I would know who has the best prices. I mean, it just doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's really a division here, too, between the parties, because if you're going to repackage it for the Republicans, they've got to repackage it as a private sector kind of plan fully, even if that's a bit of a facade in terms of getting support, it seems to me, among most of their members. And I'm not sure that you can square the circle, but, you know, we'll see.
Mm-hmm. This is why I think the Republicans feared, once it was passed, it didn't fear the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, failing. They feared it working, because that's the case now. When they're, if they do what they say, they're going to take health insurance coverage away from 20 million people. And that's the big possible blowback that they might get.
It seems to me the private insurance companies have played a large role here because of raising premiums, you know, because the health pool that they're dealing with, or the insured pool that they're dealing with, has not been sufficient to cover their costs. So they are actually the drivers of this in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Lori is with us in Moline, listening in Moline. Lori, what's on your mind with the Affordable Care Act and the state it's in right now?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, to me, it was not a complete failure. It wasn't. And I feel like, yeah, there's a lot of reform that needs to be done to it, but I feel like if the Republicans can repeal it and put something better in place, great. You know, I'm a registered Democrat here in Illinois, but I tend to not always vote straight Democrat. I feel like that they are taking this to the point that it doesn't need to go. We need to be choosing people over parties. We need to stop letting these little things, these little politics and business as usual get in the way of helping actual people. If we want to strive and move together as a country, we have to put that stuff aside and say, what is best for our people? What is best for people right now? And not necessarily sticking to our party and not being willing to compromise. Like, I can't get with it. I can't. I'm not in agreement with these Democrats. They want to sit in, dig in, and not compromise. That's not an option to me.
Okay, Lori.
I'm not the only one affected.
Lori and Moline, thanks for your view. 1-866-780-9100. Let's move on. Plenty of other politics to cover this week on Politics Wednesday. Today, with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, and your participation as well, also via email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk about this on Monday. Monday, a federal holiday, the 2nd of January. House Republicans went behind closed doors. They overrode their top leaders, voted to significantly curtail the power of an independent ethics office. No advance notice, no debate on this issue. The Office of Congressional Ethics, there's a little background, was set up in 2008 in the aftermath of corruption scandals that sent three members of Congress to jail. And this move would have effectively killed the office following a public outcry on Monday night and tweeted criticism from President-elect Donald Trump. House Republicans reversed course. Let's hear a few perspectives before hearing from Jim and Dennis here. Here's Republican Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy. He spoke on MSNBC yesterday morning, say he'd like to see a decision on the ethics office proposal delayed, but he still agrees with the plan's premise.
Well, I didn't think it was the right time to do it, and I personally believe most of these reforms are bipartisan supported reforms. If you read the task force on this that was done back in 2007, that's where most of these reforms come from. Now, let's first remember, because it seems as though a lot that's reporting that doesn't seem true. Yes, it is true that I opposed moving forward on this at this time, because I thought it was something that both parties should take up at the same time. But this entity was created so the public could register a complaint against a congressional member. This entity was then supposed to investigate, and then they move forward to the ethics committee with dismissal or to investigate further. All three of those things stay in place. All this does was make sure it puts a timeline, because people complain in the public that these investigations go on forever. So when you really sit down and read the reforms, it's not what all the headlines are saying.
Okay, Republican Majority Leader Representative Kevin McCarthy on MSNBC yesterday morning. Iowa's Representative Steve King of our 4th District said he would get rid of the ethics office completely if it were up for him.
I would repeal it completely if I had the choice.
You would get rid of the ethics office altogether. Why?
Because I haven't seen any good things come from them, and I've seen many, many bad things come from them. If you're an entity that's set up and your purpose is to accept complaints, which will be anonymous if you accept anonymous complaints at all, and then you do the investigation, you come up with these charges, they don't have any subpoena power, they don't have any enforcement power, they have to refer to the ethics committee. That's fine if that's all they did, but they're leaking information and misinformation to the press, and if they found power in doing that, and that has cost members of Congress in total millions of dollars, it's damaged political careers unjustly and probably ended some political careers early.
Okay, after those two Republican perspectives, let's go on to the other side of the aisle. Many Democratic lawmakers voicing opposition to the gutting of the ethics office. Here's a Democratic Representative Steve Israel of New York speaking on CNN yesterday.
You know, they said they were going to drain the swamp. They've just they're distributing free swimming passes in the swamp by this change in the regulations. And I'll tell you one thing. My friends over at the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, they've already started to write the scripts for the ads in the 2018 midterm election, because this issue is going to haunt Republicans.
Okay. What caused the Republicans, Dennis, to back down so quickly? Was it merely the optics?
Well, that's the word I was going to use, the optics. I mean, it looks terrible. I think the fact that Mr. Trump discouraged this or said something about it might have been a factor, but I don't think it was the dominating factor. I mean, the optics were just terrible. To a great extent, the people that turned out to vote, particularly for Donald Trump, were the people who would say a pox on both their houses. You know, his campaign was, in effect, a third-party takeover of one of the two major parties. His supporters are people that disdain both party establishments. And so what's the first thing they do? It looks as though the party establishment is creating a situation that lessens oversight of potential wrongdoing on the part of professional politicians. Mm-hmm. So the optics were just terrible.
Mm-hmm. Is there, let me point this to you, Jim, is there a case to be made for curtailing the power of this office? We heard arguments there by Steve King and Kevin McCarthy.
Well, I think the argument that's made is that, you know, there are these kind of anonymous tips that are given, and the member of Congress doesn't have any way to, you know, to confront his or her accusers here. Until it goes through this whole process and maybe even has been leaked to the press and sort of the damage has been done. I suppose you could talk about, you know, the greater safeguards. I don't think you want to get rid of the anonymous tips, the investigative reporters, if you will, of possible corruption. But I do think you want to have a better safeguard in terms of how closely held and confidential that information is kept. And then, of course, the members having at least the opportunity to respond, maybe even before it goes to the ethics committee here, because at least from what I understand, that, you know, it could go to the ethics committee even before the member has an opportunity to confront the accusers here.
Donald Trump tweeting very quickly after this move was made by House Republicans, his tweet, with all that Congress has to work on, do they really have to make the weakening of the independent ethics watchdog as unfair as it may be? Their number one act and priority, focus on tax reform, health care, and so many other things of far greater importance, point. So, Dennis said, you said it didn't have that much to do with it, you don't think, Donald Trump weighing in here?
I think that, again, the Republicans, once they saw the light of day about this in terms of the leadership's laying this out to them, I think they realized, again, as you said at the beginning, the optics were absolutely terrible. And, you know, Donald Trump has a Twitter account that evidently has 18 million, I believe, followers.
Yep.
And he can energize quite a number of people who are suspicious of politicians anyway.
Mm-hmm. Jim, go ahead.
I think Ryan, the fact that Ryan and McCarthy, you know, the leadership in the House also quickly came out and said this was not the move to make. But I do think that the fact that Trump could get a response from the Congress so quickly, I don't know if that bodes well or ill for the future here in terms of how responsive the Republican House in this case will be.
Chewing over the latest politics with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Dennis Goldford of Drake University. Hope you'll join our conversation. When we come back, we'll move on to this curious development concerning Russian campaign hacking, the controversy. Donald Trump still very skeptical about whether it was the Russians who did anything to influence our election. We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So glad to have you with us midstream on this very first edition of Politics Wednesday on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also super happy to have Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, picking apart the politics of the last few days. We talked about the Affordable Care Act developments there in the first half hour. Also about curtailing of the ethics watchdog that was set up in a bipartisan fashion in 2008, and then the reverse, of course, there after criticism from also in the GOP and President-elect Trump. And to finish up with that, before we go on to the developments with the Russian hacking controversy brought up by Diane, I read Donald Trump's tweet on that in the first half hour. But to emphasize this, Diane emailing that Mr. Trump did not take a stand on the move to limit ethics oversight, only to focus it as the first agenda item for Congress. Good point, Diane. And so does that mean, Dennis, that this will be brought up again, or has this misstep by Republicans perhaps poisoned it?
Well, I don't know that it's poisoned it. I think that media reports are making more out of it than perhaps the general public will. I mean, there was an argument by Lawrence O'Donnell on his program last night on MSNBC that with all the media attention to that shiny object, so to speak, they missed the major story yesterday, which was the budget resolution, the 54-page budget resolution the Republicans laid out. That's going to have a lot longer-term impact on what happens with the country and the citizens thereof than this particular issue. But I think that, Republicans have a very specific agenda they want to pursue. And if this is part of it for at least a good segment of them, I would expect in some form that this would come up again later.
Mm-hmm. Now let's turn our focus to the Russian campaign, the hacking controversy over our U.S. Election campaign. The Obama administration, and based on the work of U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies, says Russia tried to influence the U.S. presidential election by hacking several Democratic email accounts, among others, trying to tip the scales in favor of Donald Trump. Let's listen to one of the latest developments. Here's WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. If you remember this, these were funneled through WikiLeaks. Julian Assange talking with Sean Hannity of Fox News, answering the question of whether WikiLeaks was working with the Russian government to influence the election.
No, that's absolutely false. And if you read their statements carefully, you'll see they don't actually say that. They kind of mentioned one fact here and one fact there and nothing else. In the most up-to-date information, on the 29th of December, where the FBI, DHS, White House, etc. made a statement, what is completely absent from all those statements is WikiLeaks. Totally absent. So what's going on? Well, I believe two things are going on. Number one, they don't have the evidence that WikiLeaks is involved in that way. Now, why am I confident about that? Well, because there is one person in the world, and I think it's actually only one, who knows exactly what is going on with our publications, and that's me.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, he went on to say that a 14-year-old could have hacked Hillary Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta's emails. Now, Donald Trump picking up on this, appearing to side with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange over the conclusions of our own intelligence agencies here in the U.S. He tweeted also the comment about the 14-year-old that could have hacked Podesta, and then goes on, why was the DNC so careless? Also said Russians did not give him the info. So Jim McCormick, we have Julian Assange weighing in here as well, and Donald Trump seeming to side with him.
I'm not sure why I'm so skeptical of what Julian Assange says.
Perhaps give us a little background.
Well, you know, he's stuck in I think it's the Ecuadorian embassy since 2012, isn't that right? And he has some outstanding charges against him, and of course, that he's apparently not yet willing to face in court. And he also has been, of course, charged with with all of these leaks earlier on, and contacts with Edward Snowden and so on. So I guess I'm a skeptic and a doubter here that we can trust what he has to say about his contact or not, no contact with the Russians. And of course the easy answer is that there could be somebody as an intermediary that got the information from the Russians and then passed it on to...
That alternative, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking outside the New Year's Eve party at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, President-elect Donald Trump said it was, quote, time for the country to move on to bigger and better things, in reference to what he calls the so-called Russian hacking of this year's election. Let's listen to a few of the words President-elect had to say there on at his New Year's Eve party.
Well, I just want them to be sure, because it's a pretty serious charge, and I want them to be sure. And if you look at the weapons of mass destruction, that was a disaster, and they were wrong. And so I want them to be sure. I think it's unfair if they don't know. And I know a lot about hacking, and hacking is a very hard thing to prove. So it could be somebody else. And I also know things that other people don't know. And so they cannot be sure of the situation.
Like what do you know that other people don't know?
You'll find out on Tuesday or Wednesday.
Okay, Donald Trump posting to Twitter yesterday that a planned intelligence briefing for him on what he calls the so-called Russian hacking had been delayed until Friday, a development he called very strange. Dennis Goldford, weigh in on this, the continued skepticism of our president-elect about what our intelligence seems to have arrived at a consensus about.
Well, that itself is very strange. You know, people will refer to this as Mr. Trump's bromance with Vladimir Putin. He seems to admire strongmen. The fellow in the Philippines, Duterte, I think it is, and Mr. Putin. Leave the Democrats aside. Look at the Republican reaction to this. John McCain, Lindsey Graham, people like that. Republicans have always taken a very hard line, or at least a stern line, with the Russians and the old Soviets and suspicions of their particular activities in the world, whether covert or overt. And it seems that Mr. Trump goes out of his way to cut a break for or cut some slack for or to vindicate the things that Mr. Putin and his folks are accused of doing. And that's just what's just so completely strange, taking the side of seeming to take the side of foreign opponents as opposed to a fairly unified view on the part of the American intelligence services.
Do you see it that way, Jim?
I do see it that way, particularly if you add in that President-elect Trump talks so much about protecting U.S. interests, but yet he seems to be very accommodating, I guess would be the word, with regard to some of the actions of the Russians and particularly of Putin here. It is very strange. I agree with Dennis on that. How he can be so skeptical of the intelligence consensus, as you pointed out here. Now, he's going to meet, apparently, with intelligence officials on Friday, I guess now, and maybe there'll be a different tweet that comes out of that.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in Congress, a group of bipartisan senators preparing a bill to offer some sanctions against Russia. Dennis, where do you understand Congress is in the matter of in terms of these investigations? Plural investigations, a single investigation? Don't we know? Where is this going?
I don't know that we know that. I mean, remember that there are three basic things that Congress does. Number one is obviously lawmaking. Number two, as political scientists say, is representation, voicing and articulating the concerns of their constituents, whether on the House or the Senate side. But the third is very important, and that's called administrative oversight. And the party that has the majority in the chamber, and right now it's the Republicans on both sides, they determine what will be investigated and why. That's why you had these constant investigations of Hillary Clinton's emails. So they keep an eye, their job is to keep an eye on what the executive branch is up to. The question is how strongly, how intensely will and how critically will Republicans who have a vested interest in at least some success on the part of Mr. Trump, how much will they pursue these things? People like McCain and Graham seem to want to pursue these pretty seriously. Others may want to give Mr. Trump some slack for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the question is whether it should be a standing committee investigation
or a special committee investigation.
What's the difference there, Jim?
Well, the standing committee would have kind of jurisdictional limits. I think with a special committee, they would have probably a wider mandate. They would have probably some subpoena powers as well. And I think you had, like in the going back a couple decades, the Iran-Contra investigation, you had a much broader take that you could go across various jurisdictions of the standing committee.
Or the Watergate committee way back.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll wait for further updates and developments in this, let's call it a very strange controversy over Russian hacking, perhaps influencing our elections to whatever degree. Politics taking us abroad. On Sunday, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that his nuclear-capable country was close to test-launching an intercontinental ballistic missile, we term an ICBM. Now, we remember North Korea. Jim, let me get your view on this. It's been under U.N. sanctions for many years over its nuclear and ballistic missile tests.
Right.
Donald Trump, just to throw this in before your comment, Donald Trump also weighing in here on Twitter, his favorite instrument on Monday, just saying it won't happen. So what's your comment here, Jim, with this latest development? Are the North Koreans, to the best of our knowledge, close to having an ICBM that an ICBM can, by definition, can it reach, well, the west coast of the U.S.?
Well, I don't know the exact answer to that, but I do know that they've, you know, test-fired various missiles, and, you know, they've certainly shot a missile across Japan, which, you know, causes great angst among our principal ally in the region. And they've had five different nuclear tests going back to, just eight or 9 years ago here. And there's been U.N. sanctions placed on North Korea after every one of these, and it seemingly has not done very much good here. And so I'm a little bit puzzled once again by President-elect Trump saying that this, you know, this test will not happen or this missile will not happen. I'm not sure what he has in mind in terms of preventing this. I mean, there are a few options available to him, but you know, I think in the short term it would be very hard to prevent that from occurring.
Mm-hmm. Sanctions seeming to have little effect on North Korea. I mean, if it won't happen, and this has been talked about, Jim, you know, what is the likelihood of a strike to degrade that ability of North Korea? I mean, that would set off a whole host of things. We don't even want to think about.
I think that is remote and hopefully will not be. Maybe in President-elect Trump's arsenal here. Mm-hmm. I think his strategy, as much we can read into it, is to go through China. I mean, that's been the strategy of a number of American presidents here. But maybe, you know, as a negotiator, maybe Trump, you know, in terms of trade and with getting some concessions there, as well as prodding the Chinese to deal more tirelessly, if you will, with the North Koreans. But there really are not very good options in terms of North Korea because they've been so recalcitrant on any actions. We've tried incentives, various presidents, the Bush administration, the Trump administration have tried incentives, going even back to the Clinton administration, trying incentives as an effort to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, and those have sort of turned out to be a dead letter here. And the Chinese don't have very much incentive. I mean, they don't want the North Korean regime to collapse because of the refugees that might flow into their country. And also, they do not want a Korean peninsula that is Western-oriented that would, if the North Korean regime would collapse, South Korea would sort of move north and pursue unification here. So there are not a lot of good options here, and I think President Trump is going to find out that the slow process of diplomacy here is the likely best option.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, anything to add there with those thoughts on North Korea?
Well, I think Jim's basically right. I think the difficulty is when you have a regime that has basically nothing else except a small nuclear capability, that's the only reason anybody pays attention to them. The Chinese aren't happy with the kinds of test flights and test launches they've been doing, but the Chinese also don't want to give them up entirely for the reasons that that Jim gave. And you just don't have a lot of leverage for a fairly isolated country that outside of its nuclear program really is not very advanced in economically or not involved in world trade.
Mm-hmm. And the costs are so high, you know, Ben, you mentioned the military option. The costs of that options are so high for regional stability, mm-hmm. even for global stability. I mean, I just think it's a non-starter.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think here that our longtime governor, Terry Branstad, is the future U.S. ambassador to China, which you mentioned in this context, Jim McCormick. He might have, well, who knows what role he might have in dealing with this foreign policy threat. Would North Korea, Jim, be at the top of the list as of foreign policy challenges facing President-elect Trump for you?
Sure. North Korea would be right up there at the top. But President-elect Trump, of course, has said that ISIS is really his principal concern, at least as, again, as much as we can sort of read the tea leaves here. But North Korea has to be because of the kind of nuclear issue.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Many of President-elect's Trump's selections for the cabinet at senior-level posts have been meeting with senators this week in an effort to speed up their confirmation. Democrats trying to slow the process down through various means. As we close this hour, we have about 5 minutes left. Dennis Goldford, give us your overall reaction to Trump's cabinet picks. Are they in line with what he was elected on, his what he said, and is it true to what his campaign was about, as far as we know?
Well, the concern for of so-called political professionals, a term somebody used earlier, is that a great many, if not most, of these cabinet positions or picks are not political professionals. They have the least experience, if any, in governing or in running a large bureaucracy. I mean, Ben Carson, what, he's going to be at HHS, I think, Health and Human Services, or one of those. But he's never run a bureaucracy or anything like that. And the question is, when you put these people in these positions, if they don't know much about it, you know, you always need to know what you don't know in order to evaluate what somebody's telling you, to see if that person has an agenda of his or her own. Or he's got people in there. I saw this morning that I guess it's somebody from Wall Street who's going to be head of the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. Does that person have an agenda? So you've got a group of cabinet picks, not all, but you've got a group who have don't have any experience in government, in public policy, and the question is whether they will put their stamp on the bureaucracy or the bureaucracy, in effect, will control them.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, your overall reaction to Trump's cabinet picks, good choices, bad choices in your view?
Well, the cabinet is much more conservative, it seems to me, than what Trump ran on. I mean, in terms of as much as he discerned a policy platform, whether you have it at, EPA here, Rick Perry at Energy, Scott Pruitt at EPA here, Mike Pompeo, who's going to head CIA, Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. Those are some of the ones that also have been targeted by Democrats that they're going to make it difficult in terms of the confirmation hearing. So I think from my reaction was that the cabinet picks that he's taken have a much more ideological kind of perspective than what Trump ran on and sort of the kind of general themes that he struck. So that's the biggest kind of surprise. They are all outsiders, but I think that was probably purposefully done in terms of this, mantra of draining the swamp here. But Dennis makes a very fine point about whether the bureaucracy will capture them or whether they will be able to capture the bureaucracy. Many of them have had, business experience. I mean, look at the Secretary of State, who have run businesses. So they have some executive experience, and that may bode well for them in terms of running some of these bureaucracies.
Very quickly, before we go, let me ask you this, Dennis. What is your view of the transition so far when we compare it to past transitions between presidents of opposing parties?
Oh, it may be a little behind or even in some cases a little ahead of other transitions, but the problem is there's so many unknowns because, again, Mr. Trump has no history in terms of policy positions other than his promise about the Supreme Court justice, the issue of illegal immigration and the wall, and bringing back jobs. Otherwise, this transition is operating in terms of trying to get these people vetted by the senators with potential, as Jim says, opposition from Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Jim, your view?
You know, one of the things that I put together with regard to these appointees is to try to figure out what their direction is in foreign policy. And frankly, it's going to be very difficult to do that when you have the kind of appointees in the foreign policy realm, whether on national security and on national security advisor, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. It's kind of hard to carve out exactly what the direction is. And mm-hmm. Maybe that's by design, but it'd also be, a very interesting kind of first year or first 100 days to see the direction will be.
The first 100 days are still 16 days away before inauguration day. Thank you for giving us your view from this vantage point in time, at least. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Drake University. Also Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute of Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Dennis, thanks for coming into our Des Moines studio. And Jim, thanks for coming into our studio in Ames.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.